I'm John Batchelor with the author, Tanya Bronigan. Red Memory, The Afterlives of China's Cultural Revolution. Tanya was 8 years in the People's Republic of China between the first decade and the second decade of the 21st century. And the stories of the teenagers ranging across the country, or of the men, young men born into peasant families in the countryside who find the People's Liberation Army a ladder up until they run into the Cultural Revolution and are brutalized. We now turn to a story of a man who's remade himself into a lawyer after many years of struggle, but his memory is horror. It's 1970. His name is Zhang. Zhang and his father live with their mother, who's an educated and sophisticated woman who has severe doubts about Mao and what's going on. Tanya introduces to the woman at the center, Yu Sheng, her name is, it's Fang's
mother. Fang Chengmo.
Yeah, Fang Chengmo. Who is she at the time? What is she representing about the Cultural Revolution? Why is she speaking truth?
She was another very committed member of the party, like, as I've said, so many victims of the Cultural Revolution. She'd met her husband when they were both training as medical staff, working for the party. And she'd been, in that sense, a great believer. But she and her family had also been through immense suffering. So at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution, her mother was forced to leave the family home, essentially was forced to go back to her hometown. Her daughter, Zhang Hongbing's eldest sister, became a very passionate Red Guard, was one of the many who travelled to Beijing for the rallies. But tragically, that great movement of the young people across the country contributed to a huge outbreak of meningitis. And Zhang Hongbing's sister was one of those who died shortly after returning. So she'd lost her mother, in a sense. She'd very clearly lost her daughter. Her husband then came under suspicion and was criticized and persecuted and beaten pretty brutally. But then she herself, despite her years of service, came under criticism as well. And so she too was being held, was being denounced. And eventually, by the time Zhang was about 17, she was finally allowed to return to the family. But her idealism, her belief had really gone. Whether because she was so psychologically damaged by what had happened, whether she'd simply reached the point of no return, I suppose, she began to denounce Chairman Mao while they were at home and to say that everything that had gone wrong had been his fault, that the disgraced leaders had done nothing wrong, essentially, that it had all been Mao's doing.
In other words, she told the story as we would tell it today, that
yes,
the fault is in us, not in our stars. However, you arrive at this revelation by traveling to, I picture, a rural town or some town outside the big cities. I'm not sure, all cities in China can be big. Zhang takes you there, and he takes you to what, amazingly, is a gravesite. Where are you?
It's in the middle of a building site, essentially. And at first, when he takes me sort of into this backyard, I think that we're just passing through on the way to his mother's grave. And then I realize that around the stone, there's a brick wall going up. You can hear a bandsaw going in the background. There's just this sense that the grave is under immediate threat. And that's really what prompts him to tell his tale. That's when he has begun to speak about what happened and to try and keep his mother's grave secure.
All right, but we're wandering into Shakespeare territory right now, because there's something of a haunting here, Zhang. He wants his mother to know that he regrets, he's apologizing. He calls himself an unfilial son. The events around her murder are striking. She begins one night making declarations, and they challenge her father and son, write this down or don't write this down. She goes and writes it down. She said, I can be very quick about this. It's a scene that only history could give us. It's so fantastic. And they either call on the authorities or inform on her, but before that, they attack her. He attacks her. Zhang attacks her with a wash wash dish? Is that what it is?
He attacks her, he hits her, but also, as you say, even more critically, actually, they go and inform the authorities of what she's done. And that really is writing her death sentence, as they knew at the time. It is very hard, I think, for any of us to imagine what must have gone through his head at the time. He'd been through a profoundly traumatic few years, losing his sister, obviously, seeing his parents sort of disappear into this system of denunciations, losing his mother, her being away from home. And so you have a 17-year-old who must be so dislocated, and at the time is also being told that Chairman Mao is a god, as he says, you know, the song they were taught at the time. Not only is he a revered figure, but he's the one that you have to love. He sings to me, mother and father are dear, but Chairman Mao is dearer. And his explanation is simply that to him, anybody denouncing Chairman Mao really couldn't be his mother anymore. She wasn't his mother at that point. She was this terrible counter-revolutionary villain that had to be reported. But of course, he has had to live with that since the age of 17. Fang was eventually rehabilitated. Her name was rehabilitated after her death and after the end of the Cultural Revolution, like many of others and many others who died. But he has had to live ever since, not only with her loss, but with the knowledge that he and his father were the ones who sent her to her death.
She was executed publicly. Did they attend the execution? Because there's a scene where she's looking for them in the crowd. Were they there?
No. They were. And in fact, that to me was one of the most haunting things, that an acquaintance said to them, yes, she was looking around. She was looking for you.
They buried her in a mass grave that was later moved. I lost track of how many times she's been buried.
Yes, no, she was buried in a grave. And then it was, at first, she sort of wasn't wanted, in a sense, because she was this counter-revolutionary, she was disgraced. But then the authorities decided to build a bridge, I believe, and so they moved her body. And so this time she was, I suppose, simply an inconvenience by that stage. But there was something so terrible about the life of this woman, whose belief and whose love and investment in her family had all really turned to ashes, and then even in death couldn't be allowed to rest in peace, it seemed.
And Zhang tries to talk to her. He says, again, it's Shakespeare. She never answers me. He feels like another one of those scenes. We had one with you, we had one with the composer. Is he out of body when he talks like that to you? She never talks to me. He's trying to communicate with her?
I don't know. He's in some ways a very controlled person, I would say. But clearly at the same time, a man who, as I said, has lived with immense amounts, not only of grief, but also of guilt and distress.
He says, I brought the guardian to see you. He does he think she's there listening?
I don't know, to be honest. I think the overwhelming impression I really came away with is of a man who is trying to live with something that really most of us simply couldn't live with. One of the things that a psychotherapist I spoke to for the book said to me, you know, increasingly I've come to admire people just for surviving. And perhaps that's what I think of when I think of Zhang Hongbing.
A detail about the town. Is this with the hotel, the Buckingham Hotel that was in
the Buckingham Palace Hotel, yes.
Which you said was the dirtiest and most disorganized hotel you'd ever been in. What has happened to that area? We've gone past, China's rebuilt itself, and it's only emphasizing the towers. Have little towns like that been bypassed? Have they been leveled? Is that why they keep moving his mother's grave?
Well, no, I mean, they're in this extraordinary phase of development, particularly at that stage. Everywhere you went in China, there were cranes on the horizon. As you know, everything was being dug up, everything was being overhauled. I talk in the book about, you know, going away and discovering that all the noodle shops that used to be sort of opposite us have just kind of disappeared under the bulldozer, but then equally a sort of a park springing up in their place in a matter of days. So it was a time of extraordinary transition and transformation. And in a way, I think that's also partly why it's often seemed quixotic or even perverse to talk about the past in China, because it was just so hard to keep up with the present. And yet it kept reinserting itself into people's lives. There are obviously some things that can't be left behind.
The book is Red Memory. Tanya Bronigan is the author. The Afterlives of China's Cultural Revolution. We're going to Shanghai to a conference of psychology and psychotherapy and psychiatrists to talk about what has happened to not only the victims of the Red Guard, but their children and their children's children. I'm John Patrick.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.